Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Steve Gazzella, president of the Massing Polling Group, here with Jennifer Smith and Stephanie Murray in Politico Massachusetts. We're so glad to see you all again because we are here for another edition of The Horse Race live stream happy hour. So we hope you, all of our fans out there in the greater horse race universe, are enjoying something responsibly, partaking in your drink of choice, just like we are. Stephanie and Jen, what are we drinking today?
I have an Aperol Spritz. I stepped up from just having a beer last week. I have a real drink, so I'm more like Jen.
That means I stepped down because I got a Lagunitas today, so I guess I'm slumming it by that standard.
Well, I took a lateral move because I've got a normal cocktail and a nice glass every week. So this week I'm going with a Pimm's cup. So nice. Yeah, it's a good thing. But guys, are we drinking the incredibly sad end of what has been the only thing anchoring all of our weeks?
It's really the end of Listen to Your Heart, the Bachelor franchise spinoff that has entertained us for the past 2 months in quarantine, is over, which has driven us to drink even more. I don't know what we're going to do. I suggested some new reality streaming options to the Horse Race crew in our weekly group chat that we have, and they made fun of me, so I guess we won't be watching, I don't even remember, Twilight again.
I was going to say, in fairness, Twilight, we made fun of you even when we started watching Listen to Your Heart, so, I think that's not necessarily disqualifying, but sorry, Jen, go ahead.
I was going to say that it's a bit more troubling to me that you put Twilight in the reality TV category, because that says something about your grasp of reality right now, where it may be quarantine time, but I don't think we've got vampires outside.
Okay, well, in my defense, I think I've made this point on this podcast before, but Edward, spoiler alert, became a vampire during the 1918 flu pandemic. So maybe if we all watch Twilight as a group and discuss it, we could learn something.
That is a deep historical cut there, Stephanie. Very impressive.
Oh, synergy. Yes, but we're not the only people watching. Well, actually, no, we haven't talked about this. Are you guys watching anything now that Twilight does not count as reality TV and Listen to Your Heart has been taken cruelly away from us?
Back to the regular stuff for us. It's just, cranking through old episodes of Parks and Rec and finishing up Poldark and kind of those kinds of things. Nothing really worth wasting weeks worth of our viewers' time and attention with. Stephanie, how about you?
I started watching Outer Banks on Netflix, a show about some teenagers who live in the Outer Banks. And I thought it was really exciting and intense. And I Googled it Outer Banks to read what people were saying about it. And the first headline I saw was, "What is Outer Banks, the new teen drama, and should adults be watching it?" So, so I don't think I'm a good authority on what anybody should be watching.
Totally fair. I mean, I can one-up you because what we finished binging in this household is a show about Norwegian teenagers in Norwegian. So, now we've just gone back to the nice, reliable, the good wife, the good fight universe here, getting back into the law mentality. But sadly, no more teenagers to do their crazy shenanigans on my screen.
Speaking of shenanigans, we also asked our fans on Twitter what they've been streaming, what their trash guilty pleasures, or just what they've been watching, and we got some pretty interesting answers. Our good friend and several time previous guest, Ed Lyons, said he watched Space 1999 for the first time since 1976. I'm not sure what that means. We got a vote for Molly's Game. Tiziana Deering, the host of Radio Boston, said the old BBC movie called The Race for the Double Helix. We had a viewer say that he watched a 25-minute YouTube video entitled The Miracle of Sudoku, and many other things. Lots of interesting answers there.
Yeah, that's right. But it's not just podcast day. It's also poll drop day. Because Steve, you were up very early this morning talking about polling about transit, which we are or aren't still taking at this point.
We're not still taking transit. Not a lot of people hopping on the MBTA at this point, which we've certainly seen in the usage statistics. But yes, we also, this is my favorite day. This is poll release day. We'll have lots to say about that. Also a little bit later, we're going to have Commonwealth Magazine reporter Sarah Betancourt on to talk about it's a story that she's written. I'm going to mute myself because my kids are storming in the background, and someone else take it for a little while here.
Yes, Stephanie, why don't we talk a bit about what's going on here in Massachusetts? What's up with Catherine Clark and supply chains?
There's just so much to talk about. So Congresswoman Catherine Clark earlier this week filed a bill. Oh my goodness. I think that Steve's kids should replace him as co-hosts.
Yeah, as long as it's replacing him and not us. We need job security here. We're going to unionize like Joe Kennedy's staff.
Oh, man. We'll get to that a little bit later. But Catherine Clark is calling for a supply chain czar to kind of be in charge of the medical supply chain, the PPE, somebody who kind of works as a liaison between the states and companies that need it and companies who are producing it. And then that person would also report to Congress about any shortages or price gouging or things like that. And this is something that she's been calling for about, I think, a little bit over a month. She wrote a letter with a couple of dozen House colleagues last month calling for this person. There's language for a supply chain czar in the HEROES Act that Congress just passed, and now she's filing the separate bill calling for it. So, you know, it's something to keep an eye on, especially here in Massachusetts, where it seems like personal protective equipment, that PPE, is still in short supply. And especially as businesses start to reopen, more people are going to need it. So that's something that I'm keeping an eye on.
Yeah, and I mean, in other news for the Massachusetts leadership delegation in the House to do with the HEROES bill, you've also got Rep. Rich Neal, who's been calling for emergency funding for the Postal Service. So there was $25 billion in relief in the HEROES Act designated for the Postal Service that, again, is heading forward, but will probably end up with a pretty serious issue in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, of course, said that the Postal Service funding in the House bill is a non-starter, but Rep. Rich Neal is still pushing for that, basically saying, again, the Postal Service is an essential service right now. So that's your update from the Massachusetts congressional delegation.
And the Postal Service, I mean, beyond just being the way that we get our mail and everything like that, it's also become sort of a political issue with all of this vote by mail drama that's swirling around in Massachusetts. All sorts of different lawmakers and activists are pushing for different versions of vote by mail. President Donald Trump is now weighed in, really kind of against vote by mail.
Right. And it led to the big Twitter drama of this week, which is the president, of course, was so against the concept of vote by mail. He shared a bunch of kind of unverified conspiracy theories about the process of voting by mail that actually led Twitter to do a very unusual thing and note that they were not entirely factual, and you could check those later, which led to another Twitter meltdown. So vote by mail. Very controversial. And of course, I think, as you note correctly, Stephanie, that's bled into kind of the broader discussion right now about what do you do with the Postal Service during a quarantine. It was already strapped and it's kind of facing additional hardships now. So it is, in kind of my view, a little bit unfortunate that those two conversations have kind of turned into kind of political footballs.
Steve, are you back with us?
Yeah,
I am back with us.
Do you have children still?
There's quite a racket happening outside my door. So for those listening later, it's you were spared the visual, but it's a little active.
That was adorable.
It was adorable. Yes, it was. My 2-year-old came running in with a lightsaber, telling me that she was a stormtrooper. So there you go.
I love that.
Maybe you missed the visual. We'll put it that way instead. So anyway, the other big thing going on this week, of course, and sort of for the next few weeks, is the Kennedy-Markey race continues to bump along. We've got a debate coming up in less than a week. We've seen a couple polls out recently which show Kennedy with some size of a lead. Not entirely sure what size of a lead that is, but that campaign continues to be very active. I saw you and Stephanie tweeting about some hyper-local news. So I need to ask, what on earth is with the Kennedy sign that you were talking about in Dorchester? What was the significance of that?
Yes. So as I'm sure you all recall, I'm not sure if we've talked about it in the past, but local IBEW Local 103, which is a very large union based in Dorchester, and they notably endorsed Ayanna Pressley and Joe Biden as well. And the head of that union, Lou Antonellis, was actually on an episode of The Horse Race way back in the before times when we were in a bunker to talk about his support for Ayanna, but they came out pretty early for Joe Kennedy, and part of that includes the giant billboard looming above their headquarters that Stephanie drove past very often in the before times.
Yes, I used to drive past it to go to Jen's house or maybe to go to Quincy to get some food for takeout. But Jen noticed a few days ago, right, that the Kennedy sign was off the billboard, first time in a long time. And maybe that had something to do with the fact that Kennedy's campaign staff just unionized, which is kind of a, and they joined that union. So this is kind of something that's gained more steam among Democratic, especially progressive campaigns. Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign unionized. Senator Ed Markey's Senate campaign unionized last month and became the first statewide campaign to do that in Massachusetts. And now Kennedy's campaign is also unionized. So.
Yeah, and the sign is back up, so everything's as it should be over at the IBEW Hall. But let's talk about now, Steve, the real reason that I'm sure you agreed to come back onto the mic rather than going to deal with your family, which is the transportation poll that we were referencing earlier. So the economy is reopening slowly, but a major area of uncertainty is still the state's transportation system, because up to now, we've seen a lot less of every mode of travel, really, as people are kind of staying home. But what about when people start going back to work? Do things return to how they were, or does the future look a little bit different? So our good friends at the Mass Inc. Polling Group set out to explore those issues in a poll released today. Steve, let's talk about the poll. What was this actually measuring?
Yeah, so this was a poll of residents statewide. We, since the beginning of this, of the coronavirus outbreak and shutdowns and everything, we've been looking at different policy areas, trying to figure out what the situation looks like now, and also trying to figure out sort of where it's going. I don't think we can do that perfectly because people's opinions are going to continue to change. You know, this is something where every week of experience, every month of experience adds to our understanding of what coronavirus is all about and what things we can do and can't do, what we should do and shouldn't do. But we wanted to look, as the economy is starting to reopen, what are people's views of using different modes, using the T, walking, driving, et cetera? What has their experience been with work from home? What would make them comfortable getting back on the T? Or is everybody just going to hop in their car and we're going to face, you know, a car apocalypse that makes our old life look, you know, sort of look good in the rearview mirror? So that's what we set out to learn.
Yeah. And you actually, are we going to be experimenting for the first time on the horse race with some graphics here? Do we get to show people actual visuals?
We have visuals. And if I click this, then hopefully my computer won't shut down and everyone can see that we actually have, actual graphics from a poll.
Oh my gosh. Look at this. Incredible.
Anyway, so what this first one shows is mode shift. In other words, what modes are people plan to be taking more and less of as the economy reopens? And we see that the top three, walking, driving alone in your own car, or riding a bike, so are all either kind of treading water in the case of riding a bike, or they're actually looking like they're going to go up. The thing that these three have in common is these are all the individual modes. These are all the things you can do by yourself without interacting with anybody sort of in the same vehicle, or in the case of like Uber or taxi or something like that, in a vehicle that somebody else might have just gotten out of, or your driver and so forth. So basically anything you can do without having to come into contact with other people. Those are the ones where we saw on balance people saying that they were potentially going to use more. So that does then immediately raise the question of whether or not there is going to be this sort of traffic meltdown, you know, that just everyone's going to get in their car and there's going to be a backup from, you know, Dorchester to Rhode Island.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's striking me as I looked at that chart itself is it's a dramatic swing. It's not like it's close between people who are saying, I'm going to drive alone in my car versus maybe carpool with one other person. They're saying like, I'm not going to be anywhere in contact with another person when I'm traveling somewhere else. So, I mean, what's the worry about implications as far as the T itself? You know, why were you looking at ridership there, given that the T is saying that it's going to be reducing its maximum capacity and continuing to do so?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. I mean, and brings up a really interesting set of other issues, which is what would make people comfortable getting back on the T. Governor Baker and Secretary of Transportation Stephanie Pollack did a press conference today where they talked about some of the measures that they're taking to try to reduce crowding on the MBTA. So things like trying to have fewer people per vehicle on buses, and some of the complexities that that introduces, trying to have fewer people on the on subways and so forth, and the kinds of limits that, that they might have to create. And we see some of the reasons for that when we look at this poll. It makes, in addition to the public health reasons, you know, it helps prevent infections. It also makes people more comfortable. So the chart we're looking at right now, the red bars show the percent who would make who say that they would be comfortable riding the MBTA at peak times after the outbreak, after the worst of the outbreak has passed. And then you see in the blue bars, the percent who say that they'd be comfortable riding at off-peak times. And you can see there's many more people who say they'd be very or somewhat comfortable riding at off-peak times. So that's one big thing, is trying to spread out the riders a little bit to ride at different times of day. That's something that we heard that the secretary talk about during our press conference today. The other thing that they talked about was all the different, and the other thing that would make people feel more comfortable is all of the different measures that they can take to kind of clean the MBTA and make it more sanitary and make people feel more safe and comfortable on it. You can see here on the background, somebody's riding their own motorcycle past my house at a very high rate of speed.
Steve's house is the loudest place in the Commonwealth today.
But some of the things that would make people feel more comfortable would be things like hands-free sanitizer dispensers, frequent vehicle cleaning, some of these crowding measures you also see on here, real-time crowding information, limiting passengers on vehicles and platforms. But as they said, you know, as they said during the press conference, some of these things are not simple. They sound simple, but they're not. If you just run, for instance, one of the things that they mentioned was if you just run the same bus down the same route, it's always going to be full by the time you get to certain stops closer to the end of the route. So people at those stops will never get on the bus. You know, those are the kinds of things that they're talking about sort of how to deal with, since there's not really a playbook for this. But the idea of reducing crowding and the idea of doing better with kind of sanitation and cleaning are very big issues in terms of making people comfortable riding the T again.
But Steve, do you have, I mean, the issue that comes up in my mind is just, you know, how they even enforce, if the T figures out a way to reduce capacity in a way that's fair, how they enforce, you know, no crowding on buses or trains, how they, I mean, they've said that it's going to be difficult to even enforce the mandatory face coverings for people. It just seems like this issue of people being comfortable enough to get on public transportation is going to be difficult, especially with this enforcement factor.
Yeah, I mean, enforcement is something we didn't really explore significantly in this poll, because I think that's kind of an issue that people may just be starting to think about. And we wanted to, the idea was to explore some things that people have been thinking about. But certainly that is one. But I think the rewards you can see are that it would, when you think about these mode shift questions, there's a big difference between whether a quarter of the people decide they don't want to ride the T anymore, or 40% decide they don't want to ride the T anymore for a while. You know, those kinds of numbers, if you can just increase every point or 2 points that you can increase comfort with getting back on the T and make people feel safe, that, you know, that can keep people out of cars and maybe help to avoid that sort of car apocalypse.
Right. And of course, one of the things that people are dealing with right now in trying to manage sort of mapping out the MBTA's future as reopening starts is, what do you do around kind of keeping rides at the lowest capacity possible if you're not really able to just kind of indiscriminately, for instance, kick people off of buses, which is, how do you amend the routes to make them work a bit more efficiently? And one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting in a very good State House News article, kind of recapping this element of the press conference, was the issue of, if you're bypassing some stops so that service can be delivered more efficiently or more precisely, you can kind of get into equity concerns, which is like, what stops are you dropping? Which routes are you prioritizing? And of course, what we should all be keeping in mind, I think, is that there's already sort of a generalized concern about inequitable impacts of coronavirus efforts around the state itself. So it'll be interesting to see how the MBTA officials basically try and do that juggling while also prioritizing keeping people at a safe enough distance on trains and on buses.
Yeah, Jen, you bring up another really good point, which is equity, and that's shown up in just all kinds of ways during this, not exclusive to transportation, of course. One other that we looked at in this poll, which makes a big difference on transportation, is working from home and the people who have had the opportunity to do that. One thing that could really change the future of transportation is how many people now having experienced what it's like working from home, and their employers have experienced it, how many of them now decide that they want to continue to work from home, and how many of them are able to do so. So we've looked at that as well, and we found that this first slide here is the number who said that they have worked at home all or part of the time up to now during the crisis, and we can see 43% said all the time, another 17 said part of the time. So the majority of people now have felt what it's like or figured out a way to work from home, and their employers have also kind of seen it. The reason that I mentioned this in an equity context is because the next slide shows the percent who say they've worked from home all the time, broken down by income and broken down by education. And you can see for those listening to the stream later that the numbers we're talking about, there's huge differences. Those who have high school or less in terms of their education level, 25% say they've worked from home all the time since this started. Up to advanced degree, that goes up to 71%. So huge gaps there. We see the same gaps by income where it's just not equally distributed who has had the opportunity to work from home. So certainly that could help to reduce some of the trips, particularly during the most busy times, you know, the rush hour, if we kind of go back to the way things were. But there are very real equity concerns to consider. But then the payoff is that on this next slide here, it shows 41% say that they prefer to continue working from home, and another 29% say that they'd be willing to. So this is where there's one area where if you can get some people back on the T, a huge number can start working from home, and you manage to increase biking and walking, which is another thing people support, redoing streetscapes, you might be able to avoid a huge car apocalypse.
Well, I think we're gonna leave it on that note as we continue podcasting from home. I think at this point we are sort of podcasting from home experts, even though my Wi-Fi isn't working well today. But we're gonna shift gears a little bit. So thank you, Steve. And now we're gonna welcome on Sarah Betancourt to talk about the unemployment portal, the state's unemployment portal, and how different languages are being added to it, which is another kind of touches on that equity conversation that we've been having.
Yes. So unemployment claims in Massachusetts have been in the tens of thousands each week. The toll of coronavirus is promising to be a brutal and long-lasting impact on businesses and workers alike. But for weeks, many residents haven't been able to navigate the state's unemployment website in order to file a claim. Before yesterday and today's editions, the only languages available were English and Spanish. Commonwealth reporter Sarah Betancourt spoke to several people who advocated for the translations, and she joins us today on The Horse Race. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Doing all right. Nice to see you virtually.
Yeah, you as well. I love your house.
It's not my house. I'm just here. yeah, normally I have gray walls. Today they're blue and there's just lots of pastel decorations. So for a long time, only Spanish and English speakers could access the state's unemployment insurance website. Now there's been an addition of multiple new languages, as you reported, Portuguese, Chinese, Vietnamese, and Haitian Creole. So why is this something that you've been watching in the first place? Who was concerned about these language barriers?
Well, I remember at the beginning of coronavirus, at the beginning of the pandemic in mid-March, there were an increasing amount of restaurant workers that were being laid off, and a lot of them were Latino. So I got some tips saying, we're having a really hard time filing because the unemployment portal isn't in Spanish. And then as the weeks wore on, even House Speaker Rob DeLeo, Bob DeLeo mentioned, you know, this is something that needs to change. And so on April 10th, it did change. Governor Baker made that announcement on a Spanish media station. But he also mentioned that day, well, we're going to have the other major languages within a few days. And it's been 6 weeks since then. And so people just kept mentioning it to me. And then yesterday, we decided to report on it.
These are, of course, major issues because you mentioned some restaurant workers you heard from early on, but there's just a huge number of residents all across the state that speak a whole array of other languages. Do we have any sense of what usage has been like how many people have been accessing these translations or anything like what the impact has been so far?
Well, I don't necessarily have data on who's used the Spanish version of the unemployment portal since April 10th, for instance. But that would definitely be a great question. I do know that there's a lot of agencies, like even Greater Boston Legal Services, where their forte wasn't always helping people with the unemployment portal, but they sort of just became these de facto unemployment specialists. And so when I talked to Bethany Lee today, who hadn't heard that there were now Chinese, Vietnamese, Haitian, Creole, and Portuguese added in the past 24 hours, she had mentioned, well, we helped over 1,200 people file unemployment claims. And that sort of situation is replicated in small nonprofits and attorney groups across the Commonwealth.
And so the fact that there was no real announcement of the new languages added, any inclination as to why that was? Is this reflective of other communication problems that you've been running into while reporting on the impacts here?
Well, it was really interesting because in terms of the Portuguese situation yesterday, I had seen that Rep. Liz Miranda had tweeted out about a letter that was sent by the Portuguese caucus asking the unemployment agency, well, you know, this was promised 6 weeks ago, what happened? So I started following up. I made several calls and sent several emails to the governor's office, the labor office on a state level, and no one was really answering. And then yesterday I was talking with another legislator who I mentioned in the story.
Antonio Cabral?
Yes, Antonio Cabral. And while we were talking, he was actually like, wait a minute, they just updated it.
Oh, goodness.
And he was like, that's funny, because 6 weeks ago, I asked about this, and I wrote a letter to the governor, and I spoke with the unemployment agency, and they said, we'll have it up in a couple of days, but it's been 6 weeks, and well, here we go. This would have been very helpful to have had several weeks ago, if not 2 months ago. And the language equity discrepancies are something that have translated into so many people filling out a question wrong and then having to wait several more weeks to get their unemployment money.
Right. Is there an idea of what the actual impact has been over 6 weeks, or do we just kind of have, estimates, obviously, of how many people speak any of these given languages who might be impacted? So we're kind of doing like back of the napkin math to figure out what the inconvenience might have looked like.
It's mostly back of the napkin math. The state isn't keeping track of this so far. It's really a lot of attorneys sort of saying, all right, we've helped 1,200 people here. Talking with another major organization in Western Mass saying we've helped 400 families in the past few weeks and sort of adding up the numbers that way. But there is a pretty significant portion of Massachusetts. I think it's around 1.5 million people who are traditionally not English speaking, and a growing number of immigrants as well. And I'm sure the census will eventually reflect how many more multilingual speakers we have.
Sarah, thank you for that. I also just want to ask before you go, you've also been reporting on the boards of health having to serve as both educators and enforcers when it comes to safety protocols. So I wonder if we could just ask you to describe a little bit about what that means, what it looks like in practice, and how that's kind of taking shape as the economy starts to reopen.
Yeah, so I mean, I think everyone knows that local boards of health have a lot of already existing jobs, like implementing environmental policy on a local level. They're sort of the local arms of the Department of Public Health. But now they have this added sort of task of going around to businesses and making sure they're following the rules. And right now, there's no sort of statewide regulation. If you're a long-term care facility or an acute care facility, then you need to file paperwork for the state around reopening, but businesses don't have to do that. So it's really up to customers and employees to report any issues they see. And in some situations, Worcester, for instance, last week had 35 instances in one day. And they're only expecting those to grow as pools reopen, the weather gets nicer, and people start exploring what it means to be in the new now.
And you said 35 instances of what? Of different violations or kind of all the same thing? What were those all about?
Yeah. So a few of them were restaurants or facilities, personal care facilities like hair services or hair salons who weren't supposed to be open during before phase one. And then after that, there were businesses that are supposed to be open in phase two, opening in phase one. And people have to go over and say, here's the guidance issued by the Baker administration. You can't open for a couple of weeks. In other instances, it was people not wearing masks, not social distancing. There was a restaurant where they were only supposed to be doing curbside pickup. And I guess they were having people come into the restaurant and sit down. So these are things that the state isn't really allowing to happen yet. And so boards of health sort of go around and remind people of that. And after the third instance, they can start filing for cease and desist orders.
Gotcha. Well, I'm sure obviously this is something you're going to keep an eye on, not just on the language front, but also obviously in terms of how exactly you enforce these rules and what that looks like practically. So again, Sarah Betancourt of Commonwealth Magazine, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Sarah.
Which brings us to what, folks?
It brings us to our favorite part, and the part that we still don't have a jingle for, but we're still hoping that someday we will have a horse race trivia jingle. The question last week was, Hall of Fame jockey Chris McCarron is famous for big time wins, including multiple Kentucky Derby, Preakness Stakes, and Belmont Stakes victories. He was also born and raised in Massachusetts. And if this clue wasn't enough to tell you who won, who this was, which neighborhood of Boston did he grow up in? If that's not enough, you should really stop listening to the horse race immediately. Jen, what's the deal here?
So I'm happy to report to you live from Nantucket that the answer to this question is Dorchester.
Yes, so of course it would be.
He grew up in Dorchester, and this brings us to what is probably my weekly plug for all things Dorchester related. You recall a few weeks ago we were talking about the ramp up to Dorchester Day and how much of a bummer it was for people that it doesn't really look the same this year. Normally there would be a parade in Dorchester. There will not be a parade. Please do not go outside and parade. That's
a real
that's
bummer.
My ask.
I mean, it's yeah. a bummer. I know it is. I haven't been down there much, but I know that it's just a huge deal for Dorchester and mm-hmm. for all the people that I know and love in Dorchester. It's a bummer. So anyway, that's all the time we have today. I am Steve Gazella of the Massing Polling Group.
I am Jennifer Smith.
And I'm Stephanie Murray. And I apologize that my Wi-Fi hasn't cooperated this afternoon. So I kind of had to take a backseat, which was kind of actually nice to just listen to the conversation for once, if like a horse race listener. But that's all from me.
That's good. We're glad to entertain you, Stephanie.
Our producer this week and every week is Libby Gormley. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Do leave us ratings and reviews to pad our well-established egos and help others find us. Please make sure to sign up for Politico Massachusetts Playbook and do give us a call if you need any polling. But for now, thank you all so much for listening, and we will see you next week.